Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, who became widely known in 2010 as the Ground Zero Imam. He's the visionary behind the Cordoba House, the founder of the American Society for Muslim Advancement, and he is the author most recently of Moving the Mountain, Beyond Ground Zero to a New Vision of Islam in America. This book, writes Imam Rauf, will show why it is so important to reclaim religious and political discourse from the extremists of all faiths who dominate so many of the headlines. It's a work that advocates moderation in theology, in jurisprudence, in governance, and in politics, as well as in matters of culture, gender relations, and worship. Imam Rauf, I'm so pleased to have you on Counterpoint today to talk about Moving the Mountain.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's a pleasure for me to be with you today.
Imam Rauf, one of the things that I liked about the book is that you thread your own story through your effort to explicate your vision of Islam. You tell stories about what you learned from your father and your own spiritual journey in America. Tell us a little bit about your biography, which in many ways is a typical American immigrant story, but it's also one that's exemplary of the richness of Islamic culture.
Indeed, I was born in Kuwait of Egyptian parents and raised for 5 years in England and 10 years in Malaysia. And since 1965, I've been in the United States. So I have lived through a cross-section of not only different, you might say, Islamic cultures, but also in Western cultures as well. Therefore, I see each of these cultures as part of who I am. They're not external to me or, you know, the other. I am part of each of those. And in my own story, I always felt that I was never completely one of the guys because I was always alien. I was always different. I was culturally different. As much as I wanted to fit in, I never completely fit in. And when I came to this country at the age of 17, the United States, that is, at the age of 17, I really felt like Humpty Dumpty, you know, broken apart and trying to seek my own identity. Who was I really? And my search for identity really precipitated not only my spiritual search, but it also helped me resolve the different parts of my identity and how to cohere them, if I can use that verb, into a coherent whole.
It seems you learned many lessons along the way from your father.
My father was born in Egypt and for the first 30 years of his life lived in Egypt, graduated from Al-Azhar University, which was the, and still is, the preeminent seminary, you know, or equivalent of a seminary in the Muslim world, in the Sunni Muslim world especially. And then he was sent by Al-Azhar, for whom he worked all his life, to various parts of the world to establish religious institutions or to study. And that's how we, you know, he went to Kuwait and England and Malaysia and the United States. And from him, I learned not only about the religion itself, but also got to see a living embodiment of Islamic values and Islamic scholarship. Islam is a religion of law, as Judaism is, although it does have a very rich as well spiritual tradition called Sufism or Tasawwuf in Arabic. And my father, like most people his age, at a certain stage of his life, participated in the spiritual Sufi orders as well that was dominant in Egypt, the Shadhiliya order. From him, I also got to meet some of the greatest luminaries of the Muslim world, the intellectual, you know, the big people, Sheikh al-Azhar, and some of the greatest scholars of Islam, living scholars of Islam, from both the Muslim world as well as the Western world. Since my father went to Cambridge University and London University, he also was friends to many people. I grew up, you know, around the dinner table, meeting many of these people and learning from them, seeing their own discussions, their own doubts. Professors who would lecture and reveal a certain kind of personality, but around the dinner table among themselves, expressing their real doubts about certain things, which gave him far more nuanced understanding of my faith tradition as a living tradition and seeing some of the greatest minds and how they actually dealt with the challenges of their time.
So in this book, it's almost a kind of manifesto for a moderate Islam in religion, politics, and culture. You title it Moving the Mountain. I think you take that from scripture. Why? Why is it called Moving the Mountain?
It was a title that was proposed to me by a friend of mine, and it seemed to grab the attention of both our publishers and many of my friends as well. It also is symbolic of the enormous task that faces us in the world today. But also, because Jesus said, you know, if you have faith, the weight of a mustard seed, and you tell that mountain to move, it will move. It also is symbolic of the fact that we human beings, as the nexus or the connection point between the heavenly realm and the earthly realm, because we straddle both realms, have the ability to move mountains. We can do this. The old proverb, which I grew up with in England, I think I can, you know, the train that's chugging up. And then you say, I did it, I did it, I did it, as you reach the apex. The human quest for anything, any challenge that we have proven to ourselves that we can solve almost any problem if we work together.
So let's talk a little bit about the specific problems that you're working through in this text. On the one hand, it's about extremism within the Islamic world. And on the other hand, it's about Islamophobia. These seem to be the two mountains that have to be moved in order to move forward.
Indeed. And you can look at these problems from many different points of view. And it's advantageous for us to select different points of view for different purposes. I personally believe, from my own experience, that the real enemy is really extremism. And extremism has been a problem for the last century, at least, and if not longer, you know, much, much longer. But if you look at the big problems of the last century, whether it was the Soviet communism, you look at fascism, you look at Nazism, you look at all the evils, comes about from a certain kind of extremism. Extremism that is of a racial kind, extremism that is of a political kind, I mean, extremism of an economic kind. I believe that in the United States today, for example, we are battling political extremism that really has reached a peak at the time of President Obama, with a Tea Party extreme right wing that have made it impossible for the center, because you have to govern from the center. A democracy works when people from the right and the left get together and the center pulls the center together. Extremism has prevented the center from working. So political extremism has been our problem in the United States. If you look at the economic meltdown of 2008, you can attribute to what you might call economic extremism, the kind of greed that led people to want so much at the expense of the common good. And religious extremism is the other bane today. Whether you look at extremism from Muslims, which is now the major factor that is of concern to people, but if you go back, even extremism from other faith traditions is a problem. So the challenge today is, how do we get the moderate middle, whether they are moderate Jews, moderate Muslims, moderate Christians, moderate atheists, to moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans, moderates in every area, to strategically put together key coalitions of people who can strategically and tactically turn the needle. That's the major challenge of the day today.
One of the ways in which extremists legitimate their position is oftentimes by saying that they represent the true believers, the true adherents of any given faith tradition. So you open your book by distinguishing your own approach, and you call it authentic Orthodox Islam. And you oppose this to Islamist or radical jihadist or militant Islam. Can you reprise why appreciating this distinction is actually really key to your message?
It is key, because the challenge we have is also one of framing or phrasing. People don't like the word moderation, because moderation tends to imply that you are not really very firm or very strong and very fervent in your beliefs. That is not the case at all. That is why I say that orthodoxy, the genuine Islam, or the genuine Christianity of Jesus Christ, the genuine Islam of the Prophet Muhammad, was not wishy-washy in any way. But the Prophet made it very clear, and in fact he pointed out in some of his hadith, which is his teachings or his sayings, where he said that, I warn you of extremism, something which derailed people of the former religions. Do not be extremists in your religiosity, because that will derail you. And this is actually what we are seeing happening today. Many people get derailed from genuine religiosity and spirituality by their extremism.
And I think one of the things that I liked so much about the book is that, in general, it serves as a wonderful primer just for educating people about authentic Orthodox Islam as you go through all of the various facets of it. And we're going to do that together.
One very good example of that, in our tradition, which is a legal tradition, we have a fundamental principle in our jurisprudence that says there's more than one way to be correct. You know, we have what we call the four major madhabs, schools of jurisprudence. And as I speak to many of our audiences, my Muslim audiences, I tell them, you understand this, you know this, that there's at least four answers, at least, right? And why do you behave like only one is correct? Because it is this notion that only one is correct and all the others are wrong, which is at the root of what I call the extremist mindset that presumes that there's only one way to be correct. And our tradition itself anybody who studies it says, yes, there are four madhabs or five madhabs, and actually there are even more than that.
And so it becomes a basis for reducing the complexity of life and the answers to these big questions to simple formulas and to sound bites oftentimes, which become the basis on which the rhetoric of extremism is able to propagate itself, right?
Correct.
Let's dig a little bit deeper. I want to set the stage being your call for an American Islam and what it has to contribute more generally to global Islam. I was quite intrigued by the fact that in many respects, Jews and Judaism serve as a model. So you say that the controversial Cordoba House, located a few blocks from Ground Zero, was modeled on the 92nd Street Y, a Jewish community center in New York. And you write, and I quote, "The very fact that the predominantly Christian United States has the largest Jewish population in the world means that American Muslims can live and practice the multi-faith relationships envisioned by God and the Prophet more easily than Muslims anywhere else in the world." Can you talk a little bit about why the Jewish experience in America is a good example of what the Muslim experience might well be, since in many ways these are very similar communities?
Yes. For one thing, the United States was founded by our founding fathers who were concerned about the freedom to practice their own religion. So it was actually established as a God-acknowledging state, as a religion-respecting state that respects the concept of the freedom of religion. I think that's a foundational aspect of the United States, which I think was very important. The fact that it may not have been perfectly practiced is a separate question. But structurally and existentially, the United States was formed on this particular worldview. And therefore, when immigrant faith communities immigrated to America, of course, they had to elbow their way. They went through a certain phase. But the Jewish community in particular, which shares with Islam both being part of the monotheistic faith traditions and also being a very absolutely monotheistic tradition. I mean, to us, the notion of the strict monotheism is very, very, very key. It describes the kind of narrative that Muslims are currently undergoing. Most faith traditions and ethnic groupings as well as they immigrated to this country underwent a phase of, you might say, anti-Italians or anti-Germans or anti-Jews, or anti-Semitism as we call it. And now we have Islamophobia, anti-Muslims, for various reasons. But what happens in the narrative of when religion immigrates to a particular society, and this is true of all faith traditions, is that as the faith tradition takes root in a particular culture, it expresses itself in the institutional norms and forms of that particular society. So let's say Christianity, when it moved from Palestine to Egypt to Syria, to Greece, to Russia. You had the Coptic Church, the Syrian Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox. We even named them by their countries. Then you have the Roman Catholic Church. Then you have the Dutch Reformed Church, the Anglican Church, etc. The point is that when that happens, it happened to Islam as well, is that Christianity or that religion is not seen as a Palestinian phenomenon. The Greeks don't think of Christianity as a Palestinian religion. They think of it as a Greek religion. So did the Russians, it was a Russian religion. The Italians, they think of Christianity in the Roman Catholic Church as an Italian religion. The Anglicans think of it as an English religion, so forth. The same thing with Muslims. Egyptians think of Islam as an Egyptian religion. Turks as a Turkish religion. There's no Pakistan 80 years ago. Pakistanis think of Islam as a Pakistani religion. So what has to happen and will happen is that once Islam is seen as an American religion, then that will help address the Islamophobia that we see. Because then Islam will be seen as part of the natural expression of what it means to be American. Just as today, Jews are considered part of the American fabric. I'm not saying that there's zero anti-Semitism, but Jews are recognized as being part of what it means to be America. When an American cultural Islam, in terms of its laws, in terms of its culture, in terms of its social norms, gender relations, that are part of what it means to be American, it will help address both the issue of Islamophobia, but also to play an important role in terms of influencing Islam around the world. Because if you look at the influence of American Jews, for example, upon global Judaism, it had an oversized impact because America is the global superpower of today. If there were, let's say, Jews in Rome, for example, when Rome was at its peak, or its zenith, then, of course, you'd have Roman Judaism would have a much greater influence on Judaism in the rest of the world. So the same thing is going to happen here, and it already is happening. The influence of Muslims upon what we see in the Muslim world today in terms of the Arab Spring. Muslim Americans or American Muslims played a role in promoting democracy and democratic values in many parts of the Muslim world.
Well, of course, there were Jews in Rome at the height of the Roman Empire, and they eventually became Christians. And so, of course, they did end up having a hugely global impact as such. But your point is very well taken. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. I'm speaking with Imam Ra'uf, popularly known as the Ground Zero Imam, about his vision for an American Islam that might become a model for the 1.6 billion Muslims globally. What I was thinking of when I asked you that question was really the link between Judaism and the law, the centrality of the law. So all of the ways in which it becomes a part of culture that you spoke about, it has to navigate this in relationship to its understanding of the law. And like Judaism, Islam is a jurisprudential faith tradition. In your chapter on Islamic jurisprudence, which I have to say was, for me, one of the most illuminating, you talk about how Sharia law, it's become a shortcut for everything that is supposed to be wrong with Muslims. An exemplary of this are the efforts to make Sharia illegal, which have even been proposed in the Tennessee legislature. Give us at least a thumbnail overview on Sharia and why Americans should not be afraid of it.
Well, to say Sharia law is to make it illegal is like saying to make the Ten Commandments illegal, because the Sharia flows from the two commandments which are common to the faith, to our faith traditions. Islam, let me repeat again that Islam is the last of the Abrahamic faith traditions, and therefore we share with Christianity and Judaism the fundamental commandments, which when Jesus was asked what was the greatest commandment, he said to love the Lord thy God with all of your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. Then he said the second commandment, which is equal to the first, is to love thy neighbor as thyself. And then Jesus adds, upon these two commandments hang all of the law and all of the prophets. Well, Islamic law basically starts from that. And it divides all commandments, all divine commandments, into those that are first commandment laws, which is pertaining to worship of God, love of God, meaning how we pray, how we give charity, the fasting of the month of Ramadan, our pilgrimage to Mecca. These are all first commandment issues. And any book on Islamic law begins with actually those issues, what we call acts of worship. And then the second commandment law, which really pertains to what we call in secular law, personal status laws, criminal law, what you call business law or law of contracts, and then later on laws of governance. So it matches very much the structures of both Jewish law, Christian canon law, insofar as that was developed, as well as what you might call modern law in all of its aspects. And therefore, Sharia law is really no different than that. And it covers everything, just like kosher laws, for example, the dietary laws. We have our dietary laws, we call them, you know, halal food or whatever. The ridiculousness of the proposition that Sharia law should be disposed of or made illegal is that I'm licensed by the state of New York to conduct weddings in accordance to Islamic law. Well, that is Sharia law. We bury ourselves in dead according to Sharia law. So there are many aspects of the law that are actually fully consistent and do not contradict American law in many ways. American law also allows us the space to have our dietary laws if we wish. Just to have kosher laws is not against the laws of the United States. We have halal food. We can dispense of our estates according to Sharia law, which requires certain beneficiaries like spouse. You cannot disinherit your children, for example, from your estate. So the only thing which is an issue is the penal code, how people are punished. But the same thing in the Talmud, in the Jewish law. People do not apply those laws of punishment anymore. In most of the Muslim world, there are 57 countries in which Muslims are a majority, and many others where they are a significant minority, like in India and many other countries, these laws are not even practiced. There are some countries, two or three countries, Afghanistan under the Taliban, certain parts of Pakistan, Nigeria, which have tried to reintroduce this idea of this ancient penal code. But by and large, this penal code is not applied in countries where that is a issue. So the fear is that we're trying to imply these penal codes here, and that's not the truth at all.
It seems as if one real key to sort of getting beyond the stereotypes about things like Sharia, which is code for some people, has to do with interfaith dialogue and interfaith relationships. You've emerged as one of the leading voices in America for Islamic interfaith relations, and you've spoken on hundreds of occasions in synagogues and churches about how all of the Abrahamic traditions, as well as other faith traditions, share more in common with one another than what divides them. But you end your chapter on multi-faith relations by stating the theological and historical connections between the three Abrahamic faiths do not, I realize, address the very real conflicts between, say, Hindus and Muslims, or between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Can you unpack this for us a little bit? How are the Abrahamic traditions similar? But also, why is the appreciation of these shared values not going to solve political conflicts where religion is often the vernacular in which the conflict is expressed?
Excellent question, Jonathan. Fights usually occur among those who are closest to each other. And conflicts are usually about an asset which both sides value. Most of the time, the assets are about something of economic value or something of a power value. And they're interchangeable. You can exchange money for power and can utilize power for money, etc. So if you look at the issue of, let's say, the conflict between Israel and Palestine, it's fundamentally about land. The asset there is land. And the conflict has been couched in religious language, but the core issue is land. If you solve that conflict, then the perception that there's a fundamental conflict between Jews and Muslims that go back to the time of Ishmael and Isaac, which is really a myth, will be dispensed with. Because the fact of the matter is that Jews have been living in much of the Muslim world for so long that they become acculturated. Egyptian Jews, Moroccan Jews, Syrian Jews, Iraqi Jews look more Syrian, look more Egyptian, more like their countrymen culturally in all of their aspects than the religion really differentiates. So we need to solve these conflicts. The same thing happened, let's say, if you look at the Irish problem between Catholics and Protestants. It wasn't really about the difference between Protestant and Catholic ideology. It was the fact that the Irish Catholics felt they didn't have parity with the Irish Protestants in terms of the economic pie and the power pie. And once that problem got addressed, then the problem between those two faith communities gets addressed. And you can create problems between any kind of groupings of people on the basis of skin coloring, of race. In Rwanda, on the basis of tribal identity, can create a gender conflict between men and women. You can create all kinds of conflict over any kinds of difference. So that is not a difficult thing to create if you want to create something. The key is to recognize what is the real asset which they are fighting over, solve that problem, and then the rest of the problem becomes relatively downhill in terms of solving.
But isn't interfaith dialogue really one way to sort of distinguish between these things, by at least getting groups to understand that in fact their shared values, which may be the first principles on which they act in these economic and political conflicts, actually share more in common than what they tend to believe?
You're absolutely correct that the importance of interfaith dialogue is multiple. The very first level, it is to shatter the myths that there's a fundamental existential hostility that must be the status quo between these two groups, whatever they are, men and women, blacks and whites, Israelis and Palestinians, Muslims and Jews, whatever, to shatter that myth. But secondly, to build friendships across those relationships. And thirdly, which is more important, to build important coalitions across that to help solve them. Because the problem, let's say, of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will be best solved when Muslims and Jews, or Arab Christians and Arab Muslims and Israeli Jews, who are moderates, work together to strategically turn the needle
against the extremists who continue to use the language of religion as a means to divide.
Exactly. And on both sides, both extremists, let's say, on the Muslim side or the Arab side, the Muslims on the Jewish side or the Israeli side.
You mentioned that in some of these conflicts, they come down to gender conflicts between men and women. And I found the chapter on gender in Islam very intriguing as well. In what will surely come as a surprising claim to many, you maintain, and I quote you here, that the Prophet Muhammad brought enormous changes for women and to their status, explicitly and implicitly, so much so that I consider him an early women liberationist, remarkable for his time. Having said this, in no way do you deny gender inequality among large swaths of Muslims. There's, of course,
Indeed. Gender
inequality in American society, and most Americans probably are not aware of the fact that there have already been women prime ministers and presidents in the Muslim-majority countries of Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey, Kosovo, Senegal, Kyrgyzstan, Bangladesh. But this seems like one area where your own effort to shape an American Islam, or Islam in an American idiom, can really be transformative, pushing forward what you term the Prophet's groundbreaking desire to continually improve the status of women. Can you talk a little bit about your views on this, but also your efforts, the seeds that you and your wife have established to push forward gender equality?
Certainly. Well, my wife has started a number of initiatives under an overall initiative called WISE, which is a Women's Initiative for Spirituality and Equality, and has done a number of projects, one to end female genital mutilation, or female circumcision as it's called, an African practice, a pre-Islamic African practice, not really an Islamic practice at all, but which many Muslims think and believe mistakenly is an Islamic practice, by not only educating people about the fact that it is not part of our religious tradition, by getting local people, experts, local imams and so forth, to tell the people that it is not so. But also we recognize that the people who had a vested interest in maintaining this were those who made a living from it, midwives or certain women who would conduct these operations. We actually did a pilot project in Egypt where it is common, by helping this individual midwife get an alternate source of income to substitute for her lost income from this horrible practice. So we discovered that it's not enough to address the problem from a religious argument. You also have to help people have an alternate source of income to fill in for that lost income from that source. So it is projects like this. We also have a project in which we have gotten a program to train women muftis, women jurists, women scholars of Islamic law, who are then qualified to argue the case. And as a result of this initiative, we have discovered very quickly that in countries like Palestine, in Syria, in the Emirates, there have been enough female jurists, female judges of Islamic law, mind you. And by the way, just an interesting point, a few months ago, I was introduced by a rabbi friend of mine from Israel to a Sharia court judge who is a member of the Israeli bar, who hears cases on personal status law according to the Sharia law recognized by the Israeli government. So here's a case where the Israeli government enforces Sharia law on personal status cases in Israel and the occupied territories. And many people from the occupied territories come to his court because they want the enforcement mechanism of the Israeli government to support his decisions. I think in the context of a discussion of Sharia, that's a kind of an interesting anecdote that I thought I would share with your listeners. But going back to the gender issue, we have projects like this, which we believe will be helpful because people, unfortunately, in our community hear from traditional sources which are not highly educated. They hear about one interpretation. They don't know the breadth and variety of interpretations within our faith traditions, all of which are deemed correct, and which give us the flexibility in terms of how we choose these decisions in the modern world today, including the West.
And here you're speaking specifically about wearing the hijab or the headscarf or head coverings specifically. It sounds to me like that's what you're speaking about in the abstract, that there is a wide variety of different approaches having to do with dress codes for women.
In fact, the jurists said that, you know, from classical times, they said that the issue of dress code, and let's say for facial hair for men, keeping a beard or a mustache, is really a function of cultural norms. Whatever is culturally normative for that society is deemed shara'i, which means deemed having the force of law. And there have been many interpretations. In terms of what the woman should reveal, there are many different interpretations. Some say that the hijab is required. Some say it's not even required, because in traditional societies, women actually breastfed in public. And based upon that, some interpreters say that the female breast is not part of the awr, which has to be covered, which needs to be covered necessarily, of course, if there's a reason for it. But the key thing is that the women should dress modestly. The dress code should not be sexually provocative to strange men.
Imam Faisal, thanks so much for being with us on Counterpoint, for helping to clear away at least some of the misconceptions, and for moving us from ground zero towards the common ground of some of our shared values.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.